You are listening to Kubernetes Bytes, a podcast bringing you the latest from the world of cloud-native data management. My name is Ryan Wallner, and I'm joined by Bhavin Shah, coming to you from Boston, Massachusetts. We'll be sharing our thoughts on recent cloud-native news and talking to industry experts about their experiences and challenges managing the wealth of data in today's cloud-native ecosystem.
Introducing Wondersuite from Bluehost.com, the tool that makes WordPress wonderful for everyone. Website creation is hard, but now with Bluehost, you can answer a few simple questions about your business and goals, and the Wondersuite tools will automatically lay out your WordPress website or store in minutes. Seriously. From there, you can customize your design, pick your brand colors, and add blocks. No custom theme or coding required. You'll get content suggestions that you can keep or revise, and with Yoast SEO built in, we automatically help you get found in search engines. From step-by-step guidance to suggested plugins to an AI-powered help bot, our built-in tools make WordPress wonderful for everyone. Whether you're a beginner or a pro, you can join over 2 million Bluehost users. Go to bluehost.com/wondersuite. That's bluehost.com/wondersuite.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, wherever you are. We're coming to you from Boston, Massachusetts. Today is September 14th, 2022. I hope everyone is doing well and staying safe. Let's dive into it. Before we get into today's news and topics, Bhavin, what have you been up to lately?
Oh, I'm back to the mode where I'm in front of my keyboard, front of my monitor, just doing things. I think I made people jealous when I spoke about my Glacier National Park trip. So I think I got assigned a lot of tasks.
I mean, you certainly made me jealous, but I don't get to assign you any tasks. So.
No more. So I've been like heads down working on things. I know we have KubeCon coming in a month and a week. So like 5 weeks, which, okay, sounds really soon.
It does. Yeah.
But other than that, I think I'm sad because summer is almost over. I don't know when the official transition happens into fall, but I follow an Instagram channel here in Boston, and they are like, and last week they had a post where like, oh, today is the last day when sun will set after 7 p.m. in Boston. I was like, damn it. Like, okay, we have to get ready for that early sunsets.
Yeah, I consider this late summer or pre-fall, whatever you want to call it. It's not fall yet.
Yeah.
I think until I see frost, it's not like officially fall for me. It's got to be real cold at night, you know, when you wake up.
Yeah, I'll stick to that definition too.
It's just me clinging on to the last bit of summer is really what it is.
Nice. What have you been up to? I know you had an awesome trip.
I did. Yeah, I spent a good amount of time up in the Green Mountains in Vermont. If anybody's from the East Coast, the Green Mountains are sort of a beautiful New England national forest. And I was at the top part of it without cell service for about 4 days, which is glorious. If you haven't tried it, go ahead and try to go off the grid a little bit, safely, of course. I was doing camping and an adventure, off-road dirt bike riding, basically, for about 4 days. And it was wonderful, taxing on the body, but fun. I came back uninjured.
Okay.
Score. Yeah. Which is good. It's the best scenario, I think. Mm-hmm. And I realized, you know, just how nice it was to just be off the grid a little bit. And you're coming back to all these, you know, notifications and stuff. I encourage it, especially in this world that we live in, technology. We're always consuming information. Mm-hmm. So it's nice to give the brain a break.
Whenever we meet in person next, I do need to ask you this like new to New England question. Why do we have mountain ranges after colors? Like there's green mountains in Vermont, there's white mountains in New Hampshire. What's going on there?
Your best guess is as best as mine, probably. I don't know the answer to that question. It's a good one. Probably something to do with something a long time ago is my answer mm-hmm. to most things like that.
Nice.
Cool. So why don't we jump into the news before today's topic, which is Kafka and Kubernetes. And we have a really great guest. We'll introduce him in just a little bit. But before that, let's jump into this week's news. Bhavin, why don't you kick us off?
Yep. So as always, whenever I find a new acquisition or funding round, I like to talk about it. Mm-hmm. So Isovalent raised their Series B funding round, $40 million. I think just scaling, right? They are the maintainers of the Cilium project and Cilium Enterprise. And if you're using any managed Kubernetes service, or even if you're deploying vanilla open source Kubernetes clusters, more likely than not, Cilium is the CNI that you're using. So they're just using this to expand and support, get more customers. I already see a few open positions on Twitter that Isovalent has started sharing, from product marketing to technical marketing. So I think they're just using this money to scale and serve more customers. In other news, like non-acquisition or non-funding news, AWS had a couple of announcements. So they launched something called as Amazon EKS Anywhere Curated Packages. And what do we mean by curated packages? These are just open source projects that Amazon Amazon has tested with their EKS Anywhere or EKS distribution, EKSD. And they can now ship it or have it as available as a catalog for people. So these can be things that fall into one of these following buckets. It can either be something that's Amazon built, Amazon scanned, Amazon signed, Amazon tested, and Amazon supported. So these are, at the end of the day, they are open source projects, but you can rest assured that this is something that the AWS team is testing on EKS Anywhere and then making it available to their users, which have those enterprise subscription. Another news in the EKS open source ecosystem, Carpenter, which is their compute and memory based capacity management open source project. It's just in addition to their cluster autoscaler. They now have a new feature or a new PR that was just merged around cluster consolidation. So that allows you to set policies in place where you can actually remove nodes from your clusters if they're not being used at the optimal level. Like if you have a really big EKS cluster which is not being used, what Carpenter can help you do is move workloads around to a subset of nodes and then remove the nodes that were not actually being utilized. In addition to removal, they can also help you replace with cheaper instances. So all of that is just getting added to the open source project. So if you are an EKS user, right, look at Carpenter and test out these new features. I think one last thing that I had today was from VMware Explore. If people remember, we recorded the GitOps episode while I was out in San Francisco. They had updates to their Tanzu portfolio, some renaming from something that was called Tanzu Observability with Wavefront to Tanzu Aria monitoring or something like that. Mm-hmm. But they have in addition to the renaming, they also have enhancements introduced into VMware Tanzu Mission Control, which now supports lifecycle management for Amazon EKS clusters. So if you're using EKS, you have connected it to the Mission Control interface. You can now also upgrade these EKS clusters from Mission Control rather than having to go back to Amazon's tool set. New capabilities in VMware Tanzu Kubernetes Grid, which basically means that they have taken whatever the cluster API project has in terms of constructs like cluster class. And then a quick plug, like if you want to know what cluster API and these cluster class concepts are, go and listen to our podcast that we did with Scott Lowe. But Tanzu Kubernetes Grid 2.0 has some integrations with cluster API or enhanced integrations with cluster API. And then finally, it was Tanzu Application Platform. They did add OpenShift support. So if you're using Tanzu Application Platform or TAP, you can now use it with your OpenShift clusters as well, in addition to Tanzu. And then they are adding air gap support in late 2022. So my assumption is in their Europe event in Barcelona in November is when that will actually be GA. But yeah, that's it for the news for me.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar-S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Really good stuff, Bhavan. I think the big one that I wanted to talk about was KubeCon EU 2023. yes, we are in fact talking about 2023 already. The CFPs are now open. We'll put the link to the call for papers. Some important dates you might want to keep in mind. The CFPs opened on the 7th. They closed for now on the 18th of November 2022. A lot of times those do get moved, so mm-hmm. pay attention around those dates to see if they do get moved. But the 18th of November is one to know. And then you'll be notified by the beginning of February basically. And then we will all see each other, hopefully, again in the EU in April.
Yeah, Amsterdam.
Amsterdam. Yeah, a rebuttal, I guess, of sorts. from 2020, was it?
Yeah.
Supposed to be? Yeah. So that was a good one. Get your call for papers in. And then the other one I had here was a bunch of announcements from Google Cloud Platform. Basically, there's a bunch of additional storage capabilities and storage services for GKE. The two I'm going to talk about is the introduction of Google Cloud Hyperdisk, which is the next gen instance of sort of persistent disk. If you've been using persistent disk service, this is sort of the next bit that Google Cloud has come out and basically has more IOPS and memory bandwidth to be used. The other part of this is the addition of File Store Enterprise for accessing NFS-based storage to be accessible in Google Cloud Kubernetes running on GCP. So this basically enables enterprises to modernize and bring in their stateful applications into GKE more and more. And the other one that I want to talk about was Cloud Casa or Catalogic, or Cloud Casa by Catalogic, and OnDat announced a partnership for doing data protection, backup as a service, which is really cool. I think OnDat recently came out with snapshots and things like that. So this is sort of a expected next types of support to do backups on that, those types of data for kind of recovery of applications. And
No, really I think talking about OnDat, right? I do remember seeing something over the last week where they did pick up some new funding. They didn't share like how much or what round it was. And then they had some movement, like the CEO became the CTO, and then the chief commercial officer is now the CEO. So like few changes, I think new partnerships, just moving up.
Got it. Cool. Yeah, we'll definitely include those links as well. And then there's a couple links we'll put in there. I'm not going to go into them right now. One is about CNCF live webinar about using Canister and Argo. Really cool stuff. Canister from Kasten is a really cool piece of product/code that you can kind of work with. So definitely go check that out. And then the other one is an article about Kubernetes complexity. I think this was a really great article because it kind of talks about when to consume that complexity and when the problem in front of you calls for getting Kubernetes involved in the first place. Sometimes the right answer is don't use Kubernetes. we all, as practitioners and sort of users of Kubernetes, love Kubernetes. But there are people out there trying to make these real decisions. And sometimes the answer is not to use Kubernetes. But there's good times and bad times to accept the complexity that is associated with running Kubernetes. And I think go take a read. I think it's worth it. And that's the news.
No, I agree. I think technology just for technology's sake is not cool. Like even though we like to talk about things, you should only adopt something if the overall ROI is going to be more than the amount of effort that you put in, right? Like overall benefits are larger than the amount of effort. So if you are on this adoption journey, there are definitely some benefits of using Kubernetes, even for stateful applications, things that we continuously like to talk about. But yeah, it's not for everyone, right? Like if you are a smaller organization, you just want to run one application, Kubernetes might not be the solution for you. But if you're a larger organization with thousands of developers, yeah, Kubernetes probably makes sense. So go to read this article. It does a good job about like talking about all the different things and like control plane and containers and everything that's involved with Kubernetes.
Absolutely. Cool. And so let's switch gears to the topic we have today. Again, this topic is going to be Kafka and Kubernetes. We have Justin Lee coming on the show, who is a principal solutions engineer at Confluent, and he mostly helps customers getting into Kafka, either the self-managed or the fully managed versions in the cloud. And we're excited to have him on the show and talk all things Kafka on Kubernetes. So without further ado, let's get Justin on the show.
Hey, Justin, and welcome to Kubernetes Bytes. We are so excited to have you on the show to talk about Kafka and Kafka on Kubernetes specifically. But before we dive into those technical questions, right? let's just start with, like, what do you do at Confluent, and how, like, what does your day job look like?
Yeah, I'm really glad to be here. I am a principal solutions engineer, which means I work with new and potential customers of Confluent to make sure that they're able to use our product, right? So this consists of Kafka in the cloud, we call that Confluent Cloud, as well as some customers that will run their own Kafka clusters on-premise, and we call that Confluent Platform.
Awesome. So I think the natural first question for many folks, and maybe people aren't familiar with what Kafka is. I think many might be listening to the show, but why don't we start with just what is Kafka and sort of how does it work in a high level?
Yeah, Kafka is a distributed event streaming platform, right? So it's a system where you put data in, you have producers that put data in, and then you have consumers that take data out. And we allow, you know, a whole bunch of new patterns around, you know, data distribution within your company and real-time event stream processing.
Okay. So, like, can we take an example application? Maybe it doesn't have to be like an actual customer, but like, how are people using Kafka? I listened to the Confluent podcast, and one of the use cases was really cool when it was talking about like military edge deployments, and then when the soldiers are back at the base camp, they sync data back. So like something around to explain like, okay, how does this event streaming platform actually work?
Yeah, so I think there's a couple of really obvious examples of this, right? One of the most obvious examples is when you're doing ordering things online, right? You go to like, you know, some website and order like a treadmill or something. Click the button, and that sends a message over to the retailer, and then they do some processing internally. They send you a notification, and then you pick up your treadmill, right? Mm-hmm. So all of those interactions that have occurred are, we call those events, and those are things that are occurring in, you know, some business. And so Kafka is really the event stream platform that allows you to do that sort of interactions, right? All of the things that your customer's interacting with their business, you're clicking on your website, all of those things, it allows you to track all of those, capture all of those, process all of those in real time, and then, you know, interact with them and build applications on top of that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then, so how does this differ from things like MongoDB or Cassandra, like longer term databases like SQL, NoSQL, distributed? How does Kafka differ from those?
Yeah. So one of the big differences is that Kafka is very time focused, right? It's very focused on things that are happening. Right. So like a traditional relational database or a NoSQL database, it's, think about it, you put a bunch of data in and then you can kind of operate on that after the fact. Mm-hmm. Kafka is designed to operate on events as they're occurring. So things like, oh, I've placed an order. So the company needs to send me a notification to my phone. They need to send a notification to the store to take the treadmill out of the back. They need to send me an email. All those things allow you to build experiences on top of events that are occurring.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. You know, I think when it comes to Kafka, and I've used it a number of different times, one question I have is sort of how to help people sort of understand that difference in data types. Like I know you gave an example of an application, but yeah. What's a good example of sort of that type of data that you would kind of act on?
So would another example be helpful here? Or
sure,
what are you?
Yeah.
Okay. So another example that we see, this is a good one, right? The way Kafka was initially built at LinkedIn, right? It was used to power, or it is used to power the LinkedIn feed. So if you go to LinkedIn and like scroll through the page, right, and see all like your friends and coworkers, you know, got a new job or are leaving their job or have posted something, all that's powered by Kafka, right? So it's all of the real-time interactions that people are doing with the LinkedIn platform where I say, right, I have got a new job, so I'm going to post about that. And then I want other people to be able to see that information. Mm-hmm. So the data platform that that's running on is actually, you know, Apache Kafka, because that's where Kafka was founded or where Kafka was created. And that's different from, again, like the, you know, traditional or more traditional data systems where it's a little bit more, you put the data in, then you process it in batch or you process it like at the end of the day. It's right. Like, here are things that are happening in real time, and it's a stream of events that can be interacted with and processed and consumed.
Yeah, I like the term stream of events, right? I know in the case that I've used it in the past, it was from sort of an on-premise data center where we were streaming sort of data from traditional data sources to sort of newer consumers in the cloud. So we had this basically stream and kind of that use Kafka in the middle to kind of stream those messages to different data sources and things like that. So I think that's what makes it click for me. Who knows? Maybe it does for others as well. Cool. Yeah.
I think my next question is like bringing it back to Kubernetes, right? Since this is Kubernetes Bytes, like why the move to Kubernetes? Like Kafka, as you said, was developed by LinkedIn or contributed to open source community by LinkedIn at some point, and this was a few years back. Why the change, or why should people consider running Kafka on Kubernetes?
I think, well, okay, so there's a couple parts to this, right? Kafka is, at its core, a distributed system, right? So you have multiple components that are running together. There's zookeepers and there's brokers, mm-hmm. and realistically, there's many of each, right? And they all have state, and they all have are storing data as long as you want them to. And you need a way to orchestrate that in large systems, right? So the benefit, obviously, and you all know this probably better than I do, the benefit of Kubernetes is that it manages lifecycle, right? If a container goes down, if a pod mm-hmm. goes down, Kubernetes will restart that. It also manages things like storage and networking and things like that. Mm-hmm. Those are the things that are really hard in large-scale distributed systems. So Kubernetes solves a lot of the problems that come with large-scale distributed systems.
Gotcha. Okay. No, thank you. That helps, right? Like there are the inherent benefits of Kubernetes that actually help Kafka as that streaming platform. Like my next logical question, right? Like how do I run it or how do I deploy it? Like what's the next step?
Yeah. So there's a couple of options. One of them, right? Obviously, I work at Confluent, so we have a product for this. We offer a product that we call Confluent for Kubernetes, and this is a fully featured operator that runs on Kubernetes. You define your Kafka cluster, your Zookeeper cluster, and a CRD, and then the operator takes care of the rest, right? So that's our offering. There's mm-hmm. also open source offerings. So I know that some people use StreamZ and to very good effect, and mm-hmm. I know that that exists. I'm mm-hmm. not an expert on that particular tool, but I know that's the other option in the ecosystem.
Gotcha. I think, whenever I search for Kafka on Kubernetes, StreamZ is always like number two or three as the option. Like I haven't seen like more advancements like over the past few months from StreamZ, right. But that's always the result that shows up. So I think when you introduce yourself, right, or introduced Confluent, I think we spoke about how there is a managed service and then there is like things that people can run on their own. Can we talk about like how Confluent actually runs that managed service? Is Kubernetes involved at all?
Yeah, so we actually run a very, very, very large Kubernetes footprint with Kafka on top. There is a recent report that was released internally, and then we got approval to release it externally, basically. We have approximately 2,000 Kubernetes clusters on which we run our cloud platform. That includes something like 50,000 nodes, VMs, worker nodes on the Kubernetes cluster, and just about 500,000 pods, right? So Ooh. We run a lot of Kubernetes and we run a lot of Kafka. Right.
Okay. that's some huge numbers, like 500,000 pods. Okay. Trying to wrap my mind around. So like do people that are consuming this managed cloud service know that they are actually running on Kubernetes, or that's something that you just shared right now?
I mean, it's documented, right? Like it's not like from the perspective of an end user, you can't see that you're running that you're using a platform that runs on Kubernetes, but we don't really hide it, right? It's in our mm-hmm. blog posts about it. Mm-hmm. We talk about it. We do, tech talks on it. So it's a pretty public piece of information. But yeah, from an end user perspective, right, all they get is a Kafka cluster, right? So they say like, I want a Kafka cluster. I want to do stuff with it. I want to send data, read data, et cetera, right? You click a button, you get that. And under the hood, it's all Kubernetes automation on our side.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I feel like with a managed service too, if the user sees the complexity of Kubernetes, you're probably doing something a little
wrong.
You're
doing something wrong if you can see that.
Nice. No, I think the reason I was asking about this this specific deployment, right? Because people in the ecosystem are still worried that is Kubernetes the right platform for running databases or data services? Yeah. So like this actually helps a lot, right? Like we had a previous guest on our podcast from DataStax, and even their DataStax Astra service, which is a managed Cassandra service, runs on Kubernetes. Yeah. So like it just like getting these data points, like DataStax and Confluent, these guys are offering these managed services on Kubernetes that helps the ecosystem out a lot. And the numbers that you shared, right, 500,000 pods, I think 2,000 clusters and five, I don't remember the number of nodes, but those are just crazy high. So that definitely, I think, helps us tell this story. For going back to the operator, right, like if I'm doing this on my own Kubernetes cluster, is that something that's available to everyone? Is that something that I need a Confluent license for? How does that work?
It's something you can get started with for free, right? Okay. So we basically have a 30-day license out of the box. You click the button, or you install the operator via a Helm chart. You install the CRDs, everything. You can play around with that. If you're looking to use it past 30 days, you should contact us. We can figure something out, right? And I'm not going to go into the commercials on this conversation, but no, sure. That is a thing. It is an enterprise feature. It does cost money. That's part of it. Again, there is also the open source offering, Streamzy. I know I've heard customers that say that it works. I have no concerns about it. But I just don't know it that well.
Yeah.
Makes sense. Now, I think maybe there are some folks that want to know a little bit of the nuts and bolts of what is really being deployed into their Kubernetes cluster. If they are kind of going out on their own and trying to understand using the operator and deploying, Kafka on Kubernetes. So maybe if you could talk about a little bit of the different Kubernetes resources or CRDs or anything that is actually deployed by the operator when you get started.
Yeah. So there's the way I think about it is that there's two types of CRDs that we have. We have those CRDs that run pods, or that are, run things that run pods that are the actual Kafka cluster. Mm-hmm. And then we have CRDs that manage things inside the Kafka cluster.
Right.
So for the first half, the two primary ones that you're going to care about are the Zookeeper cluster, which is basically the metadata store for Kafka. Mm-hmm. And then the Broker cluster, or the Kafka cluster, which are the actual, worker nodes in the Kafka cluster. Right. So in our operator, we have a CRD for both of those. We also have CRDs for things like schema registry, which allows you to do, schema validation, connect workers, which allow you to do some of those integrations you were talking about earlier. Say we want to pull data out of a database and put that into Kafka, or take it from Kafka, put it to Snowflake or S3, right? We can run those with a CRD. We have a stream processing engine that runs on top of Kafka that's a CRD. And then we have a control plane UI kind of thing called Control Center that is also a CRD. So those are the pods that will run via various CRDs. Separate from that, we also have, things in Kafka, right? So things like, how do you manage your permissions in Kafka? How do you manage the sets of data? We call them topics in Kafka. We have CRDs for those and a number of other things that are available through our operator. And I think, again, Streamzy has similar architecture, not quite the same, but, similar layout.
So for the most part, it sounds like the majority of things can be controlled by CRDs in YAML. Pretty much. Are there things that can't be, controlled through YAML or through CRDs, or is it mostly that's the experience that you're going for?
I would say the vast majority of what you're looking to do can be. The vast majority of what you're looking to do can be managed through CRDs, right? Mm-hmm. Obviously, the data you're putting into Kafka would not be a CRD, but like the infrastructure, right, which is what the things you would want to run via an operator, all that is managed by CRDs.
Okay, got it. So I know you said a couple of different CRDs, right? Like the Zookeeper cluster and then the actual Broker cluster. I know the open source community, or at least the Kafka community, is moving towards something like a Kraft for consensus management.
Right.
Is that an option that's available using the Confluent operator for Kubernetes, or are we still using Zookeeper right now?
So as of today, Kraft is actually not considered GA, right? So if you go to the Apache Kafka Git repo, there's like a big disclaimer saying it's not ready for GA, right? It works functionally, right? But there's a few gaps that aren't complete. I don't know them off the top of my head, but there are things that don't work yet.
Okay.
And it just hasn't been tested, or it hasn't been run in production really anywhere. So we are working on supporting that with our operator. And once that is available in the open source, we will work on adding that to our operator. But as of today, you still do need a separate Zookeeper cluster.
Okay, got it. Thank you. So I think next question is around like connectors, right? I know we mentioned getting data from databases into the streaming platform, or writing data to databases from the streaming platform. I think traditionally we did have something like syncs or using databases at that endpoint. If I'm using Kafka on Kubernetes, is that something that we already have integrations for? Like if I wanted to deploy a Kafka cluster using Confluence operator and then push it to MongoDB, how does that work? How can people make that work in Kubernetes?
Yeah, so we actually have two CRDs today that manage that, right? The first CRD runs what's called a connect worker or a set of connect workers, right? Mm-hmm. These are the actual pods that handle the processing that take data from your existing data source and put it into Kafka, or take it from Kafka and put it into a data sync, right? Mm-hmm. So sources are things like existing databases. Syncs are things like data warehouses, data lakes, et cetera. So we have the first CRD basically runs the worker nodes, right? Individual processes that do the processing. The second CRD is actually used for configuration. So you can say, I'm going to run a worker node cluster. I need to, on top of that cluster, I need to run a source connector that reads data out of my MariaDB database. And then I want to run another connector that takes data out of Kafka and puts it to S3, right? So you would have a CRD for the worker cluster and then a CRD for the source connector and a CRD for the sync connector, or however many connectors you need.
Okay, that's awesome. And does this fit into the UI component as well that gets deployed?
So the UI is, when you're doing CRDs, what we usually say is the UI is primarily visualization or observability, right? Here is the state of things that are happening. We don't prevent customers from creating things out of band, right? So if a customer has a connect worker cluster, we don't prevent them from making an API call to start a connector that does something else. So there's a little bit of like the whole, like if you have a declarative definition of something, what happens if you do things imperatively and the drift occurs there? That's just something you have to be careful of, right? Mm-hmm. But functionally, all of that works, right? You run the connect worker, you run the UI layer, the control center, and that will show you what's going on and allow you to, you know, kind of see what's the status of the state of the world.
Yeah. No, I think that's perfect, right? The way you laid it out, like declarative versus imperative. At the last episode that we did was around GitOps, and we emphasized this as well. Like, if you're using something like GitOps, don't go and make changes from the UI. So my question was more around like, okay, can I use the UI? If once I've made those connections from my CRDs or from my like CLI resources, can I visualize them, or can somebody in the team visualize them using the Control Center UI?
Yeah, we allow you, or we don't currently prevent you from doing it, but we don't recommend it if you're doing it. You know, I like declarative everything. So one of my previous jobs was CI/CD, right? I like declarative everything. Sure.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. You can get into a wacky situation, right? If you have admins making changes from the UI and others doing it you know, declaratively. So yeah, it leads me to a next question. A good lead in, I guess, is sort of best practices. You know, what are things that, you know, people should really be aware of or keep in mind if they're, you know, the one running it or using it in production?
There's a few things to be aware of, I guess, when you're doing Kafka on Kubernetes, right? So the operators make a lot of it really easy, but it is still helpful to have a solid understanding of storage fundamentals in Kubernetes, networking fundamentals in Kubernetes. And honestly, you need a pretty reliable Kubernetes cluster to get this to work, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you're doing a dev cluster, that's perfectly fine. We see a lot of customers that say, I want to run Kafka on Kubernetes in the cloud, or I want to run Kafka on Kubernetes in your data center, right? All that works. You just need to spend some time getting comfortable with all the core foundational Kubernetes concepts. And then you can start running like the more, you know, realistically, Kafka on Kubernetes, data services on Kubernetes is a slightly more advanced topic, as I'm sure you know, as I'm sure you talk about all the time on this podcast. So as long as you have those core foundational things, you're probably good to go. There's things around like, you know, if you have different teams that want access to Kafka, there's different patterns around, each team should have their own Kafka cluster versus a single large Kafka cluster. And like, how do you handle multi-tenancy? And and there's like a whole big rabbit hole you can go down that path. But realistically, the best things to do are just be comfortable and familiar with Kubernetes, and then you should be okay running Kafka on top.
Got it. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure it doesn't hurt to be familiar with Kafka and really understand sort of the ins and outs, I guess, before running on Kubernetes. But hopefully, if you've done the due diligence to learn Kubernetes, you're already half of the way or most of the way there. Kubernetes can be sort of its own animal. But when you do understand it well, you know, like you said earlier, to the point that Kafka is a distributed system. And so when Kubernetes is running well and you really understand it, I imagine those things aid well to running Kafka itself, right? So it makes a lot of sense. So I think beyond running Kafka sort of on a single Kubernetes cluster, what about its multi-cluster or multi-cloud sort of possibilities?
Yeah, so there's a couple different ways we see this achieved, right? So at Confluent, we have two high-level stories for this, right? One story is that you could have, you know, maybe you have multiple Kubernetes clusters. Some of them are in different clouds. Some of them are in different regions. Some of them are under your data center. Mm-hmm. And it's very easy to run a Kafka cluster on each one, right? So on a given Kubernetes cluster, you can run a Kafka cluster. And then between your Kafka clusters in, you know, wherever they happen to be, there are various ways to synchronize data between them, right? So there's open source offerings for this. There's one called MirrorMaker 2. There's Confluent offerings for this. We have one called Replicator and one called Cluster Linking, right? Not not going to go too deep into those, but there are offerings that basically say,
okay,
we can synchronize data between multiple Kafka clusters. The harder story is, how do we handle Kafka if we want to run a single Kafka cluster across multiple Kubernetes clusters, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
One of the core foundational requirements for Kafka is that all the brokers need to be able to talk directly to each other, right? So
right.
That means that if you want to run a single Kafka cluster across multiple Kubernetes clusters, you really need to have your networking dialed in, right? We need to be able to resolve IP addresses and pod names across Kubernetes clusters and reach IP addresses and pods across Kubernetes clusters. So we have, you know, there's various ways to achieve that.
Mm-hmm.
We have a blog post, we have a documentation. There's other companies that have done similar. Mm-hmm. So it's definitely technically feasible, but it's definitely a much more advanced use case.
Do you see a lot of people like doing that in the field? Like, I know you work with a lot of customers, or is it mostly like one cloud or one Kubernetes cluster?
I would say most customers have one cloud or one Kubernetes cluster, but not because it's not possible. It's more just they do the technical due diligence and realistically the business due diligence and determine mm-hmm. it's not worth the effort or worth mm-hmm. the cost.
Yeah.
But I have seen a few customers that are actually doing this in production, right? So there's a few customers that have, you know, multiple Kubernetes clusters, maybe across different cloud regions or maybe across multiple data centers. And then they're running a single large Kafka cluster that spans those Kubernetes clusters, and that fully works. It just, you need to be okay with the cost and the operational expense of that.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I feel like, you know, that multi-cluster is definitely more common, but then that multi-cloud has been this architecture that a lot of people have been sort of knocking on, and we've definitely seen more commonly over the last few years.
Yeah.
You know, I'd like to have the same conversation like 5 years from now and see what that word looks like. Because I feel like we are getting to the point where a lot of these technologies and sort of support for doing these kind of things and in terms of, you know, having the network that you need and those kind of different concepts are getting to the point where it's becoming more sort of operationally friendly versus making it to the point where like, yeah, it's not really worth the overall cost and sort of OPEX, you know, associated with doing that kind of thing. Cool.
Yeah, the one thing I want to call out, right? Like the network architecture is completely fine, right? Like you can set it up. We have documentation on how to do that. One thing we've actually seen more of our customers do recently is pull back from multi-cloud because of the cost, right?
Yeah.
Straight up, like Kafka is a data platform. And if you're running Kafka in production, you're putting a lot of data through it.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're pushing multiple megabytes per second or multiple gigabytes per second between different clouds, that gets really expensive mm-hmm. really quickly.
Yeah.
And that's something that, you know, customers may or may not be aware of.
Mm-hmm. No, those egress costs will definitely add up for customers. Okay, I think my next question is around like more going back to the operator, right? Like, how about day two operations? Can I do things like scale up, scale out? How do I build a resilient architecture? What about data protection? Like all of the day two operations and go.
Yeah, so I mean that's a big realm of conversation, mm-hmm. obviously. One of the big ones, especially with, you know, distributed data platform like Kafka, is that by default, you run some number of pods, right? We have disks attached to all the pods. If you're looking to scale up or you're looking to scale down, you have to figure out what to do with that data for the pods that are coming up or the pods that are coming down, right? So scaling up is a little bit easier, right? You add additional pods and then maybe you rebalance the data. And we actually have a way to do that in Confluent natively. Right? So you know, enable a setting, and then as you add additional pods, we'll take care of rebalancing the data for you. Scaling down is a little bit harder, right? So there's obviously a minimum size for a Kafka cluster that you want to run, right? So that you can have, you know, some minimum availability. But before you scale down, you need to make sure that you either cordon off that data or move that data to existing brokers so that when you delete or, you know, turn off the pod, you don't lose your data, right? So we've built a lot of automation. There's actually a lot of engineering that goes into making that work in our operator and a lot more automation and engineering that goes into making that work in our cloud, right? So it's completely possible. Mm-hmm. And again, we put a lot of work to make it as user-friendly as possible, but it's something to be aware of. The other part of day two operations, things like, you know, upgrades and how do you manage, like,
yep.
you handle patches, how do you handle security, how do you, you know, rolling up, right? One of the nice things about operators in general, and I guess our operator in the specific, is that we make a lot of that really easy, right? So you say, like, I need to upgrade from version X to version Y. I just change my YAML definition. There's a version field effectively. And mm-hmm. apply it. And then the operator takes care of rolling restarts and mm-hmm. replacing one pod at a time, right? It's kind of one of those things that Kubernetes makes easy. And then our operator leverages those capabilities to make it even easier, right? So there's, it's pretty decent to run it on Kafka on Kubernetes. It generally, you know, kind of works. You just got to, again, have the foundational understanding of what's going on to make it work.
Gotcha. No, thank you. That helps, right? And I think I do want to use you as a resource because you are so your role is customer facing. Like, can you share more customer use cases? I know we already spoke about a few different ones, but actual customers, we don't even need to like share names, but just like how are different verticals using Kafka on Kubernetes?
Okay. So I cover a couple. Okay. I cover telco and I cover healthcare and I cover financial services, or I have in the past, right? So from the perspective of how other various companies are using Kafka, right? In the financial services industry, we see companies that are doing mortgage processing using Kafka to handle like, oh, I've uploaded a mortgage. I'm going to, you know, handle the payments on that. We also see customers using Kafka for things like credit card transactions, right? So Kafka is used very heavily kind of across the financial services industry. We see something similar in healthcare, right? So, you know, as a health insurance provider or a healthcare provider, right? You have customers that come to you and say, I'm going to go to the doctor, I need to prescribe it, or I need to, you know, have a pill prescribed or whatever, right? A lot of the individual things that I'm like interacting with the business, those are events, and those events can be put into Kafka. And those events can be used for things, right? So as a healthcare provider, I can gather all of this information about my customer, right? So Justin is, you know, he goes to the doctor, he gets a vaccine, and then he buys vitamin C. And you can use that to generate a profile about your customer. And then use that to, you know, turn around and say, okay, we think Justin is a perfect candidate for, you know, advertising campaign X, which maybe he needs like a different insurance policy, or maybe he needs like, we're going to send him coupons for a particular set of products or whatever. That sort of thing is really common in the Kafka world. In the telco space, we see, you mentioned the story around like soldiers running around with a backpack with Kafka in them. One of the nice things about Kafka is that it works, it works really well as a buffer of data, right? So we're working on use cases where, you know, customers may have, you know, intermittent connectivity back to the cloud or back to the internet, right? So maybe there's like, you're in a farm or a rural area somewhere and you don't have access, or your access isn't super consistent. You can have various things around your farm or whatever that are capturing data and aggregating that locally. And then if you need to stream that to back to some central location, you can then do that, right? And so capturing different pieces of information, things like, oh, temperature sensors or our precipitation sensors or our fertilization across a larger farm, right? We can capture all that information. We can gather it together. We can say, hey, based on the temperature, maybe we need to turn on the sprinkler in this particular zone, right? And Kafka is a really good use case for that as well. So Kafka is one of those, like, it's one of those things, like, if you ask somebody, what is a database used for? What does a database do? It can be used for anything you want, right? There's all sorts of different use cases. Mm-hmm. There are all sorts of different patterns. It really just depends on what you're looking to do. And Kafka is a really powerful platform for that.
Got it. Awesome. Makes sense. Those are a wide range of different types of examples and use cases. I like it. Well, I think, you know, the next thing I think I want to ask is, you know, how can you get started using Kafka, specifically Kafka and Kubernetes? Like, where would I go first, or where would you suggest people to go first to start learning these things?
So you can go to our documentation, right? We have really solid documentation for installing the operator on your Kubernetes cluster and then getting Kafka up and running, right? If you're looking for an open source solution, there's also Streamzy, right? It's part of, you know, open source, and you can go and run that, and that works. But, you know, both of them are really solid options, and they both make it really easy to get started with running Kafka on Kubernetes.
Got it. And of course, we'll put all those links in the show notes for anyone who's looking to get started with the examples and sort of documentations that Justin is talking about. And, you know, I think, you know, with that, Justin, I don't have any more questions for you, but I think I've learned a lot about Kafka and sort of how it's used and how to get started and what day two operations looks like. And it's been a joy talking to you on today's podcast.
No, thanks for the invite. I really enjoyed it, and it was great being here. Thank you.
Thank you, Justin.
All right. That was a great conversation with Justin. I think there was a lot to get from that conversation. I know it's been some time since I've really used Kafka in production at my stint in healthcare. Like I said before, you know, the streaming concept and the types of data put in Kafka really kind of ring true to me there. So let's talk about our takeaways, Bhavan. Why don't you kick it off and let me know what you got out of that conversation.
Yeah, so for me, it was around the distributed nature of Kafka itself and how that works really well with Kubernetes. So Kafka being a distributed platform needs an infrastructure stack or a platform that can handle all of those different constructs. Kubernetes already has this figured out over the years. So it can help you with not just day zero orchestration, but also with things like making sure that you have your desired state matching the current state of your Kafka cluster. Things like non-disruptive rolling upgrades, things like making sure the node-to-node, the service-to-service or pod-to-pod communication works. All of that has already been figured out with Kubernetes. So Kafka really just fits in as that streaming platform that organizations might want to use. Mm-hmm. And the second thing that really stood out to me was the managed service that Confluent offers for Kafka and how it's run on Kubernetes itself. Like the scale that Justin spoke about, like running 2,000 Kubernetes clusters, 50,000 nodes in total, 500,000 Kafka pods. Again, he did say that there might be infrastructure pods as well in that 500,000 number. But this is the scale that vendors are trusting Kubernetes with. Basically, they know that Kubernetes is a resilient system and can help them run these distributed platforms. And they're offering it as a service and actually trusting that to generate revenue for them. So regardless of whether you are consuming their managed service or using their operator for running it on your own Kubernetes cluster, there are benefits of adopting Kafka on Kubernetes.
Absolutely. And I think going back to that article we talked about at the beginning of the podcast around complexity, this is one of those cases where it's very worth it, right? Being that Kafka benefits from, you know, being run as a distributed system on Kubernetes, that, you know, Kubernetes helps out the way that it runs and heals during failures and things like that. And being able to scale fast, right? And we know that Kubernetes enables, you know, this to happen as well. And just seeing these numbers, I think, makes a ton of sense. So. Really interesting points, and I agree completely. I think some other ones were just the different, you know, industries that Justin talked about. You know, whether that's healthcare, financial services, farming, or ag tech, with the different sensors for, you know, the different agricultural components and sort of, you know, rain gauges and those kind of things. I think Kafka is a not a jack of all trades, but it can be applied in many, many different technology scenarios. So not surprising there, but I think that, you know, that was a good point that Justin brought up. And then just, you know, coming back to this multi-cloud, multi-cluster conversation that I think we've had over and over again on this podcast. And, you know, it's always one of those topics that, you know, some people are kind of pushing and getting to that cutting edge of doing it. But, you know, Justin talked about how, you know, he sees certain customers or companies get to that point where they do the investment and sort of figure out that the, you know, the costs associated with doing that versus sort of what they get out of it might not be worth it. So, you know, not seeing as much in the field. But I guess, you know, a little bit surprising that we didn't see more of that. You know, obviously Kafka can support these types of architectures. Mm-hmm. So I'd like to have that conversation again. I think I said this in the podcast in a few years to see what that looks like with a lot of the people we've talked to on the podcast. But yeah, really great conversation. And hopefully we'll have Justin on again in the future. Again, we'll have all the show notes available for you with all the links to Docs and Strimzy and CFPs and all that. You can find that wherever you find this podcast. Go ahead and find those show notes and you can find the links there. And please, if you can, review our podcast or give us feedback in messages or direct messages on Twitter or LinkedIn or whatever. Please, we encourage you to do that. We've already had a number of different listeners reach out. Thank you to those listeners, first of all, for listening. You know, we've had those comments actually go right into feedback for new episodes. So it always really helps to kind of hear what our listeners have to say. And it, you know, really helps us out with the show. And a little plug, we will be, I'll say this for the next couple of shows, but we will be at KubeCon in sort of the second half of October. We will be there as a show, Bhavan and I, and hopefully be talking to some folks at the conference. So if you have been on the show, you're a listener to the show, come find us, say hi. We might even have you on the show. Who knows? We're gonna try.
If you have some interesting war stories with Kubernetes, right? Let's just have them on the pod, like for everyone to know.
Yeah, exactly. We're gonna try to do a live thing. It'll be fun. Hopefully have some stickers. You know, don't hold me to it. We're still in production with those, I guess I could say. With that, brings me to the end of today's episode. I'm Ryan.
I'm Pavan.
And thanks for joining another episode of Kubernetes Bytes.
Thank you for listening to the Kubernetes Bytes podcast.